This is Bob Crawford. It is 12:10:90. I'm doing a recording in the public library with Mark Wood.
House.
Woodhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Okay, let's begin here. And if you would give me your name, your age, where you graduated from, and your major.
My name is Mark Woodhouse. I'm 25 years old. I graduated from Michigan State University, March of 1990, and I'm a telecommunications major.
Let's begin with a fairly simple area, just to get some basic information on your background. If you could just give me a view of where you grew up, what the street looked like, whether it was an urban area or a rural area, what the setting was, what the physical setting was, whether there was a delicatessen down the street or whether you lived on a farm, a mental image.
I grew up in two areas. One would be Detroit, Michigan, and the other is Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now, in Detroit, the word says it all, totally urban. The area where I lived, the houses are very close together. And in fact, in our little bitty neighborhood in Detroit, pretty tight with everyone being really close together. We have a bunch of houses together. There's a couple little stores on one little corner where we live. And there's a park. If you can imagine a park with, I call them miniature mansions because they're bigger than our other houses, but miniature mansions around the park. And then we have, in our areas, little bitty houses. And it's really close together. And it's, like I said, it's totally urban. And if I can describe that area, one word to me is rough. It's a really rough area. So I always call my area outside of my neighborhood no man's land because, I mean, if you get robbed there, shot, whatever, it's like no one really knows except for the people that are in your immediate neighborhood that you've grown up with for years. And it's 100% black. That area, like I said, is really rough. It's hardworking people, and it's dirty to the extent. You know, there's trash around. But in our little neighborhood, like I said, it's really clean. The people are nice. But once you get out of it, it's rough. And in the other area, I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan, totally different. This is a 180 degree turn. I lived in a townhouse complex in Ann Arbor, near this little miniature pond where there were ducks and dogs, and everywhere was just really nice, you know, and well-educated. You know, we had a lot of people from the University of Michigan, and you had your doctorates, masters, very nice people, and there it's no fear of danger. Grass, hills.
How many years did you live in the first environment? How old were you when you switched from one to the other?
Well, it's funny. I moved around so much because my parents divorced. But I say out of my years, like 7 years I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And the rest would be Detroit. And the one thing, too, about that is that basically in Detroit I lived in two different areas. I lived in that area in northwest Detroit near Northwestern High School, near the old Olympia Stadium. And I also lived near the Renaissance Center in a high-rise apartment called Lafayette Plaisance.
Now, were you older or younger when you lived in the Detroit area?
It's funny because, like I said, I moved around so much. See, I stayed with my mom, like, when we made the move to Ann Arbor, I stayed with her up until like around 11th grade, and then I moved back to Detroit with my father. So that's why I've really been jumping around, moving everywhere.
The neighborhood that you lived in Detroit, was that essentially working class or what?
Yeah, working class.
What did most of these people do for a living?
Auto industry. We had a few teachers, janitors, but basically it's a lot of automotive.
And in Ann Arbor?
In Arbor, it was more the teachers in your high schools, also university professors. We had a few professional athletes. I think also, too, a lot of engineers. I mean, its pay scale was up there. And Well, back then, when I was living there, they were townhouses, rental. But now they've converted into condominiums. So I'm sure the salary went up even more.
When you think back on the people that you knew in the Detroit area, what percentage of the kids your age ever went to college?
God, not that many at all. If I can look in my little bitty neighborhood, I would say about like 2%, 3%. I mean, it's like out of most of my friends, I am like the only one that went to college. They pretty much didn't care for it. They didn't see any importance at all, or they didn't see the ability to move ahead and also to increase your knowledge. Just like once I get out of high school, it's over with. I'm done. I'm ready to, find a job, get a car, hang out. They weren't into school.
What made the difference with you, though? I mean, why didn't you have that attitude?
Well, see, I think the one thing, too, that helped out was that I lived in Ann Arbor. In Ann Arbor, I was really pushed to school. I mean, the schooling was like one of the most important things that I had looked at when I was in Ann Arbor, because the classes, the curriculum, especially the students, all the students were there. They were serious. They were studying. You had a bunch of college prep classes. It was all geared toward going to college. To where when I went to Murray Wright in Detroit, and also my friends around.
What was the name of it in Detroit?
Murray Wright High School. I mean, when you look at the students, their main objective was, let me just pass with a C, a D. Let me just get out of here and live my life. They wanted to get out. And then you had those few students in Detroit that were really hard workers and that wanted to get out of the city. And I think one thing, too, because I lived in Ann Arbor and, felt how it was to live in suburbia, I really liked that. And I knew that, my way out of Detroit, at least for that moment, was to go to college.
Now, the school system in Detroit that you attended, was that predominantly minority groups, blacks?
Yes. I mean, it's 100% black when you look at the students. But teachers, there was like a 50-50 when you of white to black for teachers.
And if you compare that to the Ann Arbor, what was the ratio of black and white students in the Ann Arbor system?
I think in Ann Arbor, it looked like, I think, around 70% white, 30% black.
So what you were running into was a more highly competitive situation in the Ann Arbor scene.
Highly, yes. Very competitive. Because it's funny that when I look at my years in Ann Arbor, Huron, my GPA was around like a 3.2. And I was fighting, to stay alive. Plus, I was on the football, too. So I was fighting to stay alive, academically, along with my athletics. And the minute I went to Detroit school, I felt like I was a genius. I felt like, I knew a lot. I mean, my GPA shot up to, I finished with a 3.7. In the classes, I was, always setting the scales, getting the A's in the class. But I knew, getting out of there, that I wouldn't be that so-called genius that people looked up on me, I knew that when I was going to go to college, it wasn't going to be as easy as it was in Murray Wright because of my experience at Ann Arbor Huron, because Ann Arbor Huron is such a credible school, and I mean the education was tough. I mean, it's in Detroit, I had to study, but in Ann Arbor I had to study. I mean, I had to really grain at the work and really work it out.
How do you explain the lack of desire on the part of minority students? What is the cause of that, in your opinion? The potential seems to be there, but why you have described for me this basic attitude of, let me out of here when I finish high school. I just want to get out of here. The hell with college. Where is that coming from?
I don't know. The one thing could be parents, could be friends. I'm thinking that it could be that these particular people that are hanging out, they want to hang out. I mean, they don't see, I'm talking about not everyone, but just seems like a large majority just didn't care. They didn't see, you know, what could be the benefits of going to college. And when I think about it, I'm thinking it's looking down at the generations. You know, if your father or mom didn't go to college, or if your brothers or cousins, if they didn't go to college, then that may not be an initiative to help you look at college.
Now, were you inspired in some way by your mother and father? I know you weren't living with both of them, but I mean, when you were bouncing back and forth from one family to the next, did you get shoved in the direction of education by both sides?
Well, you know, they really didn't pressure me. They let me decide what I wanted to do, but my goal was to get a degree because my father and my mother, they went to school. Like, my mom went to U of M for a while. My dad went to Western. My father got an associate's degree, but I wanted more. You know, I wanted to finish. I wanted to get, you know, a bachelor's. And because it's in my family, it's myself and my older brother. I have two older brothers, but my middle brother, he was the other one that got a bachelor's degree. And he got his first, and I got mine right after his. And I just wanted to, you know, to graduate. You know, it's like I didn't see high school as being enough. I didn't see that as enough for me to expand my horizons and to learn more and to work with people. But I say myself looking at my parents saying they didn't have this, I want to get it.
But yet they weren't pushing you. Still, why? You could have taken the path of your other friends in Detroit and said, the hell with this. What's the big deal? My father didn't graduate from college. He had a year or so, and my mother didn't really. She spent a year at U of M or whatever. And you might have copped out, but you didn't. So that came from someplace, didn't it? That desire to get that degree.
Well, you know, I think the big thing that pushed me going to Michigan State is being in Detroit. You know, in the environment, in the area that I was in, you know, I couldn't picture myself working in the media area, coming right out of school. I didn't want to just be in Detroit and just have my brain deteriorate, you know, by not expanding. There was some other avenue that I wanted to pursue. And my goal, my dream, what I was feeling inside was get out of Detroit, go to school, go someplace else, learn. And then I visited Michigan State, and I enjoyed the area. I loved it. I said, I'm going there. I'm getting out. I think that's an inner dream I had.
But it's quite unique, isn't it, in the sense that most of your friends in Detroit didn't have that drive. So you're unusual.
Yeah.
You're the only one out of your group in Detroit that ended up in college.
But, you know, I think that's too because I lived in Ann Arbor. And then I think that surrounding in Ann Arbor, being in U of M, you know, walking around, filling that campus, feeling, I think that helped out a lot. And then going to Ann Arbor Huron, that right there, being with the students there, seeing what goals and achievements they had, and seeing them going off to college, I wanted to go too.
It doesn't sound like the school environment in Detroit was very demanding, that those teachers were not really pushing the students, and they might have, or that's really a question.
Well, no, you know, in fact, the teachers were demanding. To me, when you think about it, the teachers in Detroit were a lot demanding to students who want to be challenged. And if you have, okay, you have, let's say, 30 students, and out of the 30 students, you may have like 5 up to 7 students that were serious, that wanted to go on to college. Those teachers would take a tie at those students and talk to them and encourage them. And like I had one teacher, he was my math teacher. Their math only went up to algebra. And I told him, hey, I said, I was doing the stuff that you're doing now, your junior year, I was doing this around like my sophomore year. And in the school that I was in, I told him, you know, they had calculus. And I want some way for him to teach me just a little bit of calculus. And he did. He took me aside. He, like during my lunch periods, After eating lunch, I'd go up in his classroom, and he would jot down calculus equations for me. He brought in another book for me to take a look at and said, here's some calculus, take a look at it. You know, and he really pushed me, him and a couple other teachers. But, I mean, it's like if the majority of students just want to flow through, they'll flow through. Just like looking at your looking at Ann Arbor Huron, you have all those students there, and when I looked at them, all of them were good. So, in a sense, the teacher, I feel, they didn't have to give them an extra push because they know that the majority of them were going to push themselves out, do well, graduate, go to college.
Did you sense discrimination between the teachers in the Detroit system? Were the white teachers any different than the blacks, or were they the same in the sense that they were willing to help any student who showed a little motivation?
Yeah, just that. They would show any student. And then the thing about that, too, is that there really, in a sense, in my mind, there really can't be a lot of discrimination when 100% of your students are black. I mean, there's no, like, favoritism towards any particular student of another color because, I mean, it's like 100% black.
But I meant more in the sense of you have a teacher who is white and somehow he might relate to the blacks in a general way differently than the black teachers would, or maybe there was no difference. Maybe I'm... He's still coming to you, even though the school's 100% black, he still has a basic attitude which comes from the fact that he comes from a white background and you come from another background. And maybe there was no detectable difference there. That I'm really asking that in the form of question.
Yeah. You know, I really couldn't detect... In a sense of them bringing maybe their background into it. I mean, I couldn't really see them in a sense like talking down to us, you know, trying to have them understand what he's trying to talk to you. I didn't feel that, if that's what you're asking. There, I felt that there were human beings that cared. In my particular school, with the higher advanced courses that I was taking, I didn't feel that. You know, I felt, you know, teachers who really cared. And I didn't feel any snobbishness from them. But there was one difference, though, that I did feel from this one teacher that I had was...
Who was white?
No, black.
Black.
Was a feeling of be proud of your black heritage. And of course, I would expect that because she was a history teacher. And that's the one thing that I felt from her. And also, I remember a counselor who I had for filling out university admissions. And one thing I felt with her is that she was always trying to get the students to go to a black college, which... To me, what was no problem at all, because black colleges are outstanding and excellent, you know, educationally, along with a bonus of black heritage. But, you know, my feeling was because I went to an all-black school, I wanted to go to an environment that had everyone there. You know, I wanted to go where there were blacks and were whites, and this may sound strange, but in a way, I wanted to compete with everyone and experience racism again. I mean, this, you know, stuff that I felt in Ann Arbor. I wanted to go there and experience that. I wanted to compete. You know, like I said, I was at Murray Wright, all black. I wanted to go someplace different where I could, you know, expand my horizons, think, you know, talk to people who didn't agree with you or that you just don't get along, and learn how to deal with these people, communicate to them. And I'm glad I chose to go to Michigan State University because right there that was just my number one education of getting along with people of different races, different ideologies, and just communicating.
That brings me to a question which I frequently ask and that is talk a little bit about your freshman year, who your roommates were, and what your reaction to freshman year was at Michigan State.
Well,
or did you go bonkers? Did you? What happened there?
Well, my freshman year, I enjoyed it totally. I had a bomb, if you could say. My freshman year, not only I enjoyed the academics, not only I enjoyed that, but I have to admit it, I enjoyed the party life. I mean, this is, my parents aren't with me. You know, I could, make my own decisions. I could, do whatever I want. I had this freedom. And it's just, I think of my sophomore and freshman years as the most fun I've had in being in college, because I was at that point where I wasn't taking the serious classes, your majors. I was just taking the entry-level classes, and, everyone else there, most freshmen, being all in the same boat, and I just had a ball. Well, like, looking at my floor, okay, it was, I'd say, only two blacks on my floor compared, and out of all, the floor had about, I'm thinking maybe 40 or 50. And now that didn't faze me, or, I didn't have any disbeliefs or that kind of feeling.
It had to be a little bit of a shock, though.
Well, no, not a shock, because I lived in Ann Arbor.
But you weren't living with these guys.
Yeah.
I mean, suddenly you're sharing a bathroom. You're in the, I don't know who your roommate must have been, white or something.
Mm-hmm, right.
I mean, they're shocked too. They don't know who their roommate's going to be. They've mm-hmm. never lived with a black before. Mm-hmm. And you walk into that door and you face one another. There's got to be something flips over in each of your minds. Therefore, at least it may turn out all right, but that mm-hmm. initial reaction must be a little crazy at first.
Well, the one thing about my roommate is that I remember him being a really shy guy. I mean, I was shy in a sense, but I mean, I had to communicate to talk. There's no way I'm not going to talk. But he was very, very shy and not very talkative. And if I could say that there was any problem with me and him, was him not communicating. And I wasn't quite sure, how he felt about blacks or what he thought, but as the years went on, we talked, we communicated, and that was fine. And I got along with pretty much everyone that was there on my floor. When I got in that environment, the first thing is that, hey, I'm here, I'm not leaving regardless. I'm going to stay here, I'm going to study, do my homework, do whatever, but I'm going to survive with these people. The only difference is the pigmentation, but our common sense is that we're all human. And there were bits and times where you had racial jokes thrown at you from some people here and there, but I just dealt with it. I said, okay, it's a joke, I'm not going to get at it. But then there were times too where someone would ask some stupid question, okay, and then I would just throw it around and make them feel stupid, and that way it was a challenge to me. I'm like, we're all here to survive. We're all different. Let's go for it.
And they would take it as a joke.
Yeah,
They would see that they had asked a stupid question.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I could just bring one question for you. Okay, I remember this one guy. He had asked me, okay, and it was funny to think about it, but this guy had asked me, Mark, why is there always black people down in our lobby on the pay phones? He said, every time you go down there, it's like there's a ton of black people, on the phones. And I'm thinking to myself, That's such a stupid question, because the phone is there for anyone to use. And if he walks there, they're just using it. Go to any door, that's what phones are there for. So I was thinking, yeah, this is a stupid one. So I just turned around and I added my one friend, with my black friend, the only black on the floor besides myself. I just told him, Well, hey, you didn't know this, but during certain times of the hours, AT&T, they have a new standard of minority hours, where any time between this hour, minorities can use the phone with a percentage taken off. And then there were a bunch of other friends all there, people from the floor, and they all started laughing because I knew I just turned this guy's question wrong.
That's funny.
Because, you know, I mean, it's like you ask a stupid question to me sometimes. I have to make you feel just as stupid just so we can both think about it, you know. And that's one thing that, I mean, it's funny that, you know.
You should have said blacks are the only ones who know how to use phones. they're the only ones who know how to dial.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he threw this question at me, and I was like, this is stupid, but I said, why get mad when you can just turn around and make him look just as stupid, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's funny to say that. I enjoyed it in the sense when they were, you know, ridiculous, but not like upfront, you know, cut through your heart, prejudice questions. I dealt with it, and like I said, if I could do it all again, I would do it, you know?
So generally speaking, the experience of being immersed in that white ocean was not, you know, was most of the people were pretty decent.
Right. You had a few where, you know, you know there's just nothing was there. I mean, you couldn't communicate to them. It was like talking to a brick wall, to where sometimes you wonder, is that just me personally, or is it my color? And with me, I'm the type of person where, yeah, I will still try to talk to this person. And if it gets to the point to where, you know, they continually give you the cold shoulder, then, I mean, it doesn't make any sense for me sometimes to beat a dead horse, you know.
It seems that you have a very tolerant view of people in general, very accepting view, which a lot of whites don't have who are confronting minority groups. And obviously, minority group members don't have that tolerant view towards whites either. It works both ways. Where did you get this tolerance of people that you have, which seems very healthy to me?
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I really can't pinpoint that.
Did your mother or your father talk down whites or blacks or other groups or for any reason? Were they making sharp divisions between themselves and lower class blacks or between themselves and other groups, or did you sense that at all?
No, I always got a feeling with them of like whether this may sound corny, but whether you're rich or poor, white or black, people are people and talk to them. And well, one thing too. When I look at my roots, and I found this out like during my high school year, my senior high school year, is that obviously, you know, looking at me, if you could, I am a light-skinned black person. And when I looked into my roots, I found out that I am part German, a little Indian. But when I look at it, I consider myself 100% black because of the sense of where I've grown up in Detroit. And then, you know, looking at that difference, you know, I just always thought, you know, talk to everyone, you know, communicate besides, you know, what color you are. And I think what helped out in my life, besides my parents, was being thrown in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That was a big thing to me, because when I moved with my mother and my stepfather to Ann Arbor, all my friends were, you know, 40 miles away.
How old were you then?
I was in the fifth grade, so I would have been about 12, I think, around there.
So
I go by grades, but I was in fifth grade.
From about the age of 12 until when you stayed in Ann Arbor?
Until around, that'd be close to like, 17, 17, 18, around there.
Graduation from high school, right. Practically.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, it was into my my junior year of high school.
So where does the Indian come in your background?
Incidentally,
if any of these questions are any personal, just tell me to shut up. But I'm curious.
No, that was on my mother's side. My great-grandmother, she is a full Cherokee Indian, the high cheekbones and everything. And she's a Cherokee Indian.
In the German side?
On the German side, yes. And then my grandfather, he was German.
So you may have the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, I have a mix. And then my mom, she's lighter skinned than I. And she's lighter skinned than myself. And when you look at her, you would think she'd be a white person. You know, but in fact, though, when you look at history and going back into the slave days and how the United States looks at what is black is, I'm not sure any percentage, but any droppings of black, you're considered black. And, you know, I've always considered my mom black.
How bad was it in Detroit? I mean, you were there until you're about 12 years old. It was this sort of scene that if you wandered too far afield, you were in a fight. Or is it the white stereotype of the black neighborhood where there's a junkie on every corner and people are knifing one another down the street or ripping off the local gas station? Was it really that bad? Or,
well, you know, it wasn't as bad, but I mean, it's like, well, when I look at it, but being outside of my little bitty block. I'm thinking that whenever I'm outside of this block walking, that I do not walk with horse blinders. You know, it's like when I'm walking, this may just be me, but when I'm out there, I'm always alert of what may happen. You know, I'm just out looking in every corner, you know, making sure that this, I may be paranoid, but that was just me.
Did you get in fights? Were there gang wars?
No, there weren't gangs. There were fights, but, I mean, there was people that needed money or needed items. I mean, the one thing when you look at it, crack, cocaine, heroin, drugs. I mean, when you look at that right there, when you have someone that's, you know, that has their high and they just live for the high, then they would do anything in their power to get money to continue that high. And I mean, just look at it. Crack is bringing down everything. And, I mean, it's rampant in inner cities.
If I'm 13 years old and I can make a couple of $100 for practically nothing, serving as a lookout for some drug dealer, whatever, why should I study in high school? Why is there any motivation for me to do anything other than to join the drug gang?
Well, that's a good question.
I'm not going to work at McDonald's for $5 an hour.
Well, right there, that comes at, I mean, what are your morals? You know, that's the one question there, because, I mean, when I looked at it, I had a friend. He's a good friend of mine. He's not in it anymore, but he was dealing in the drugs. I mean, he would tell me stories of how, you know, you walk in a home of a drug dealer and where you just have plastic bags filled with money. And I remember him just telling me all about that. And the one thing that made him change his mind was people being killed left and right of him that were in the gang, or not really a gang, but it was a drug, you know, a group in a sense, but he would see them dying off because they were fighting to get their power to be the head of this particular, you know, drug business. I mean, when you look at it. And that was one thing to him that got him out the violence. And then also looking at my little nephew, he got into drugs too. He was pretty much a lookout, and also he would distribute money from one place to another. And what stopped him from getting out of drugs was this one guy intercepting his transaction with money, looked at him and said, had a gun, said, give me your money. I know you have it. I want it. He took it, and then he went to his boss. His boss said, you did what? And punched him in the mouth. And that second, he turned away and left. You know, but I mean, I mean, it's a hard question overall of why should I work here when I get money here? And then the one thing that I think about it is your morals. You know, like, I mean, if you have a parent who cares about what you do, who's really concerned, and wants you to live a good life, then they will try to do their darnest to get you not to be into drugs. But sometimes you may have, I mean, it's not always the case, but sometimes you may have parents that may not care, that they don't care where you are. Why are you out so late?
So you That's always felt that your parents cared.
Yeah, they cared a great deal. I mean, they were always there for me, and they're there for me now. They always, you know, push me to, you know, just do well, you know, in high school. They didn't push me to get A's and B's and, you know, be a valedictorian. They just pushed me to do well and to do something with my life.
Talk a little bit about your decision to major in telecommunications. Was this done by a process of elimination? There you are. You got these 10,000 subjects at college. Mm-hmm. You go through the 100 level courses. You're still a little bit bewildered if you're like most of the other students. Now, why telecommunications? Why not journal? Was this after you had eliminated 16 other subjects, or did you really zero in on it because you wanted it?
Nope. I did not zero in at all in telecommunications. That was not my first objective. When I look back at it, in high school, at both at Ann Arbor Huron and at Murray Wright, I was looking at two things. Telecommunications, looking at radio and television, and also I looked at engineering. I looked at telecommunications, your television, radio. Murray Wright had one of the best radio and television stations within the school. We didn't broadcast out, but we just had it there. And there I learned a lot about the field, what to do in writing, working cameras, and that gave me a little itch in a sense of, oh, this is how it is, this is what you do. So I looked at that, and also I took your algebra, physics courses, chemistry in high school also, and there that just gave me a good base. And it's funny that when I left Murray Wright, I decided that I wanted to get into engineering. I looked at that, one thing was because of the money. That it was, at that time, looking at if I could graduate in a five-year plan, not the four-year plan, but the five-year plan, or whatever it took, that you can make a decent amount of money in engineering. And when I looked at television radio, for one thing, because of my teacher, because he was in the field, he told us about how slim and how tough it is getting jobs in that field, and also how low in pay that it is to get in that field and how competitive it was. So from looking at that and also getting, you know, some good school experience in the field, I thought that, you know, I that's as far as I could go with television radio. And then I decided to go into engineering because it was different and because the pay was good. And, you know, going to Michigan State, you know, I took all most of the calculus and physics prerequisites to enter into the school of engineering.
How'd you do in those courses?
I did the average, except for physics. That the university physics, that shot me down. I remember taking the first physics course, and I had to repeat that course because the physics was so tough. Math, I did all right in the algebra, trigonometry. I was pulling 3 points, and in my first calculus class, my first two, I got a 3 point in that, and in the calculus three, I got like a 2.5. But physics, that was tough. I mean, out of all those courses, university physics was hell.
Was that a weeding out course?
Yes, a big time weeder, and
a lot of your friends fell from that.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was like looking at engineering. That was a roach motel, you know. Especially when you're looking at blacks, You know, well, we can all get accepted. They may have the status quo that they gotta have to find students, but keeping them there. I mean, that's the big thing. I think that's one thing all universities should work on, you know, is keeping those students there.
Don't you think the fault is more at the high school level than at the college level?
Yeah, well, when you're looking at, when I think about Murray Wright, when I told you that, you know, how at Murray Wright I was getting a 3.7 there, and then looking at Ann Arbor Huron, yeah, I was getting like a 3.2. Yeah, I think that the teachers there that talk to students that are looking at college, that want to survive in those schools, that they should tell them, you know, that you're going to do a hell of a lot more studying than what you're doing now. You know, I think that they should give them a lot more harder curriculum for those college prep classes. Now there are like two really good high schools, public high schools in Detroit, Cass Tech and Renaissance.
What's the first?
Cass Tech.
Cass Tech.
Cass Technical High School, and the other is Renaissance. And those two high schools are, they have always been considered the cream of the crop of the public high schools. They have, all of their courses are college prep.
They're mostly black students?
Yeah, yeah. And, but in Cass Tech, there is a fair amount of white students. Those two particular schools, they push their students. Definitely. I mean, it's like all the classes. I mean, I've never gone. This is basically much from hearsay, from what I know, people that I've talked to. But looking at Murray Wright, you know, there weren't all these students in the classes that were all geared toward going to college. You only had a minute bit. So, I mean, right there, if you don't have a large majority of students that are willing to push the teacher, then they're not going to throw more information to you. You have to demand it. And that was the one thing that I was doing at Murray Wright. I was telling these teachers, you know, give me more. I want something else. And I think that's what they have to do. If you could look at these schools that may not have a large number of maybe you want to say talented or whatever, the students that are interested in college, let them know, first of all, you're going to have a fight going to college. It's not going to be like here. You may not be the top in the class. You may be right down there, barely struggling, but just get ready to work hard. Don't throw it away.
Well, you must have gone through a difficult period because you assumed that you could make it in the engineering field. And then you had to face the fact that courses like physics and maybe some other related courses weren't your cup of tea, and maybe you should switch direction. Now, was that a difficult time for you?
Yeah, it was difficult making that initial change from engineering to telecom. But what helped out, what made me make that change, was when I had an internship for Allison Gas Turbines, their division of General Motors down in Indianapolis. And being there, working with the people in the engineering setting, I was working in white collar, but also I would have to go down to blue collar and talk, sort of being a liaison in a sense. But there's the one thing that I did not like was my creativity being controlled, being isolated, being put in a particular canister, not being able to venture out. Now, that's one thing I didn't like about being at GM. You know, I saw everyone in ties and shirts and everyone pretty much doing the same thing. And, you know, a little bit of me, I had creativity, and I couldn't see myself being in that environment. That's when I decided right there that, you know, money wasn't for me. You know, the getting the $30,000, the $35,000, that wasn't my dream anymore. It was something else inside of me that said there's something more to life than having a BMW, and that's why I made the change.
Where, this is another question I've asked. Project yourself into the future 10 years. Where do you see yourself? If you could create an ideal home environment, working environment, what would that be?
That is such a tough question, because right now I do not know what the hell I'm going to be, what I'm going to do. It's, with me being out of school for only, I'll say, close to 8 months, and looking at how tough this field is, radio, television and film, looking at how tough this area is, I don't know when I'm going to get into it, if I'm going to get into it, or what. I really can't pinpoint what's going to happen 10 years. Well, actually, I know that if I can just draw it out and say, I would like to do this and it would happen, I would love for some instance to be in a film company working on movies, doing something, with movies, not directing or producing, because I remember I wanted to do that all the time, but when I really think about it, I don't think I have what it takes to be a producer, a director at this moment, and I'm not sure I ever will, because of the stress, the pressure, being very quick-minded, making very good decisions, putting the people together. I can't see myself doing that, but in a sense, I can just see myself helping out a group of people to put together a movie. Now, I mean, it may take 10 years. I'm pretty much looking at it, I think it will, because at this particular time and moment in my life, I'm not pushing myself as hard as I used to. When I was very gung-ho in the telecommunications field, in film and television, I was really working hard. I was doing a lot of things to just prepare myself to just get a little taste of the field. That was fine, but now talking to some people and also getting the rejection letters here and there, it's really dampened me, but I'm still trying to hang in there wondering, will something come through? And if it never does, it's because I think I didn't work hard enough to get there. But it's funny, 10 years, I really can't pinpoint it, because I don't know what's really going to happen.
What I hear you saying is that somehow some of your enthusiasm has died.
Right. Yeah, a lot of it has died.
And how old are you?
25. But, it's like, when I think about it, I want to do something with my life, something that can be fulfilling. Because I made that decision when I went out of engineering. The money wasn't there. And sometimes, when I think about it, I look at people like Spike Lee, that are doing films that are geared towards, brings out an interest within our black race. And sometimes I think that I would like to help a person, a gifted person like that, with a lot of those ideas and help bring more positive images into media. Other than, because I always remember being little, whenever you watch TV, you see a black person being a pimp or a prostitute or things that you really couldn't look up at, And looking at people at Spike Lee and seeing the interest that he's bringing with other blacks to get into the field and doing something positive, for our race, to inform and to entertain others, sometimes I look at that and say, I would like that to be my goal someday down the future. When, where, I don't know. If I don't ever do that, maybe my life won't be complete, but maybe that's something I just always keep in the back of my mind.
Are you taking steps now to try and contact people like Spike Lee?
No, I did have a rare opportunity to meet him at a communications conference fair down in Washington, D.C., and I met his producer, but as in contacting people now, no. one thing I may do, depending on if I have to go back to Detroit, because I may have to go back to Detroit, I may see if my parents can finance me to go to Los Angeles to speak with just, you know, anyone in the field in particular, just to like get my foot in the door, get a sense of how competitive, how stressful it is within the field. See, I'm thinking too that before I can even look at helping someone that's gifted, that has the idea of doing a movie, I think that somewhere I would want to work for a film company to build that experience, whether it be.
Are you willing to work for a local TV station to get experience with videography or editing?
I have, but I've sent resumes and did an internship for a local television station, but I was denied permanent jobs because I don't have more current experience. You know, it's like right now in my life, I'm.
But if someone said we need you to function as a videographer to go out and shoot news, would you take it?
Yeah, I would take it in a second.
How many local TV stations have you applied for jobs like that?
All of them. The brand new station in this area, I've looked at WLNS, I've looked at Channel 47, I looked at, talked to them, and they pretty much tell me that because, you know, the market is so small, because they always have a large number of applicants, that I was pretty much weeded out because I don't have a lot of experience with them. Even though I interned with Channel 6 and I was with them for a summer, still I didn't have the experience of other applicants who apply for positions. Well, one thing too, when I think about it, you know, I sit down again and I say, what do I want to do? And because of me being able to intern, I also interned at Channel 7 in Detroit. And being at 6, sometimes I want to know, maybe I don't want to get into television, maybe I want to get into film. Well, when I look at it at this point in time, right now, the only person I can blame is myself, because I am not pushing myself to explore and to look at smaller companies or people that are involved in film.
Do you view this as a temporary cooling of your heels, or is this something which goes a little bit deeper than that? Or have you been really overwhelmed by the level of competition and the futility of trying to get a job in this field?
You know, I think it's both. You know, when I made that big change from going into engineering, where jobs at that time were plentiful. I mean, they were looking for people to get into the field. And then when I made the decision to go into film and television, I knew that the jobs weren't going to be there. I knew that, for instance. And I just decided to go because I thought maybe I'd luck out, maybe something to come my way. And plus, because of the people always saying, you know, if it's something you like to do, you know, eventually get paid for it, in the long run, you will enjoy it. You won't count the days, you know, as your life goes on. And I always just thought, you know, maybe I'll luck out. Maybe I'll get something. But, you know, I don't know if it goes much deeper. It probably does. But starting from now on, looking at 10 years, within that 10 years, I'm going to have to move my butt somewhere and get it off the floor.
Do you have, I want to stop.
What I really learned in college, what I received.
All right.
Well, one thing I like to say too is that not only did I receive education, book-wise, learning-wise, about my field in telecommunications, not only did I learn that throughout my 7 years at Michigan State, but something that is really hurting to me, which I never thought this would ever happen to me in my life. I would look at the movies, only think this happens to others, but I found out during my years at Michigan State that I'm diagnosed as a manic depressant. And learning about this, about yourself, being in situations to where you don't know how the hell you got in those situations until you're out of the episode is something that I learned about myself, which is so tough.
Do you know when that feeling is coming on? Do you know the symptoms?
Well, you, thing about it is that you know about the systems after it's hit you.
There are no telltale signs?
Well, the funny thing about my particular manic depression episodes is that when you're slowly going into it and when you're in it, you think there's nothing about you. There's nothing different about you. Everything is the same. You're all right. But the one thing that helps you know that you're in this is the people around you. People look at me differently. They say, "Mark, what is the problem? How are you? You are so much different now." And when you're in this episode, you think, you know, well, what's the deal with you? I'm all right. I'm fine. You know, it's normal for me to sleep 3 to 4 hours a day. You know, it's easy for me to run around, be highly, highly excitable. You know, it's easy for me to be irritated easily. You know, when you're going through that phase, you're thinking, I'm all right. You know, what's your problem? I'm doing fine. But the time when you realize, what the hell did I do? Was I doing this or that? Is when you're out of the manic episode. It is so strange. It's like, you know, there are some people that may have it and that they luck out and get a drug that they can take every day that will keep their particular chemical balance in their head fine, but, you know, for the rest of their life. But there's some of us, like ourselves, that, like myself, that there's no medication that's found yet that you can take every day without giving, you know, bad side effects.
Now, how often do these attacks occur?
Well, it's...
In your 4 years of college, for example.
Well, it happened... Well, I went to school for 7 years, and it happened, I'd say, my third year in college it happened. Then it happened again in my, around my third and fourth year in college it happened. And then it happened around my sixth year in college. And my sixth year in college, that's when I know, hey, you have a problem. No, you can't blame this on other people for causing this problem. You have it, you are this, and you are manic depressant for life. It was hard.
Yeah, I see a potential trap here. And maybe this isn't an area I should get into at all, because I'm not a psychologist, this is not my field, so just accept my remark for what it is, an uninformed gut-level reaction. But the trap I see is that if I sit here and I say, I have a personality X, manic depressive or whatever it is, therefore, because of that, I cannot achieve a certain goal, whatever it is, whether it's to be a director, a mm-hmm. sound technician, I can reach a point where I will use what I believe to be my personality defect as an explanation or as a reason for all of my behavior. It becomes, it can become an excuse for everything I do, no matter whether I'm in that state of depression or not. In that sense, it can become a trap. And I'm sure you've thought about this, or maybe you haven't.
Yeah, well...
Do you understand what I'm trying to say? I don't know whether I've been very clear or not.
I think, in a sense, are you more or less saying that you have this certain goal, you want to do this, but you're not sure if you can do that because you may get into an episode?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. You're okay, now, the last time that I had a manic episode, this was this summer. And it's funny because, you know, after the two major ones, you know, I thought, you know, I know what the symptoms are, what could happen. I talked it over with my psychiatrist, this, that, and the other. And then it came up again, and it just, you do not know. And then when you do know, you say, okay, I know it. You take some medicine, something that'll set you down, put you on the floor. And so then you get up, you keep moving, but it's there again. I mean, it is so hard. It's hard to get past it when you're in it.
If somebody knows you really well, like a girlfriend or a close friend, mm-hmm. they can certainly say, hey, Mark, you're moving in direction X here. Just want to tell you about that. That can be a help, can it?
Right, it can. And they've told me. But see, the thing that you have to understand that sometimes, in my case, they can tell me, but I'm too stubborn. I'm thinking, hey, I'm all right. I'm healthy. I mean, you can have, you know, family, friends, everybody tell you that, you know, Mark, you're not yourself. You know, it's like a little tiny bit will sink in. But the majority of it, you take it as bull. It's like, no, you're not telling me right. I know I'm all right. I know I'm healthy. And that is just, that's the hardest thing about this. I mean, it really is. And, one day, I mean, I would like to meet others or maybe look into a group of manic depressant people that are together that can talk about, you know, what they do. But it is.
Have you done that?
Not yet. Not yet.
That sounds like a very important consideration or move to make.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's something else, though, when I, you know, think about my manic depression state. Because sometimes, too, you know, I've had these three major episodes that I can definitely pinpoint in my life that's in a sense that's changed my life or made me more aware of, you know, not only am I Mark Woodhouse, but I have this.
How, if you look back on the last 7 or 8 years, what segment of time have those attacks, or however you want to describe them, how much of your life has it taken away from you? What are we talking about? Has this been an episode that lasts a month, 2 months, or how long does it go on?
No, you know, the episodes, they last, on an average, around 3 months.
And this happened three times?
Three times in my life here at Lansing. But looking back in the past, too, it happened there, but I didn't know it. I wasn't aware. See, also, too, looking at my first time up here at Michigan State, when it happened, I blamed it all on stress. Stress caused me to become this way. It was a this way, this sort of thing. It wasn't, in a sense, labeled like it is now. Okay? So, you know, when it happened, it was a 3-year interval between my first and second episode here at Michigan State. My other one hit me, I would say, within a year and a half time. And the funny thing about this is that supposedly stress did trigger something in these two other manic episodes. But in this third one, I don't know what the hell happened, but my father gave me a trip to Spain, a vacation. I was, in a sense, replacing him because he couldn't make it, and he gave it to me as a graduation gift. Now, being a Spartan that I am, receiving all my experience in partying, I took this to a higher level in Spain. I had a great time in Spain. I had so much fun. Like, first of all, I had to get used to the 6-hour difference. That was a major thing. And because at times during the night, I felt like I was up, you know, I was awake, I would go out and party and have tons of fun. And then when I came back to the hotel to go to sleep, it was daylight. And I could not get used. There's one thing I can't do is I cannot sleep in an area that's well lit. And that's pretty much what was happening. I wasn't getting enough sleep. I would try to sleep a few hours, then go out on the beach. Where it was, sort of, people as listeners can picture it, a topless beach. So I had to go out.
I would have been right behind you.
You can't go out in the daytime, the nighttime, right on the beach. So I had this, and then I had to go to the bars where it was like Michigan State altogether, going out where you had like, it seemed like 20,000 bars within a 30-yard radius. I mean, there are bars all over the place, people having a great time, you know, not fighting, not any of that, just a get-together, how you doing? So mixing this, going out night, partying, coming back, taking, three, four, five hours sleep, going out to the beach, and then going straight to the nightlife, I didn't get a lot of rest during this supposedly vacation. And something happened when I left Spain and was flying over the ocean. When I got back into the United States, I wasn't the same Mark Woodhouse as I was when I left. Something happened there between that plane flight, you know, leaving the States, going to Spain, and being there and coming back. And that's when my girlfriend saw me, she had told me that, you know, you don't seem the same. And she has experienced my manic episode once before. And when I came back, I didn't notice it. She did. And then as the days went on, starting from that time, as the months passed by, that's when it's something about me. I knew something was a matter, just like a little faint thing. I knew something was happening, but then I still felt that I was all right. And I mean, it's something that you really can't describe. It's like a person that is not a manic episode, that is not a schizophrenia or whatever, they may be able to see how you are, but they cannot feel how you are during this time. It's only a person that has gone through that knows, you know, after the fact.
How does this affect your attitude towards other people? Do you become hostile towards them? Or?
Yeah, I come very irritated, pissed off at the little bitty things. Also, too, your goals, your dreams, your aspirations, whatever you want to do, you think you can do them. So, you know, when I'm in this state, I'm thinking that, hey, I can be a Spike Lee. You know, I can do that, this, that, and other. That is one of the only things that I think is positive, in a sense, about me being these manic episodes. I do what I want to do. I go for it with a hell of a lot more drive than I do when I'm normal. You know, maybe in a normal sense, I may go at it, you know, at a turtle pace. But when I'm manic, I'm that hair. I'm like, phew, I'm there in a flash. I will go. Just like I always wanted to go back to California in my manic state, I went to California. I just got my money, boom, went. No planning whatsoever, went spontaneously. I went for it. And that's just, that's the only positive thing I can say about it. But then there's so many negatives about that particular, you know, brain disorder that it's just, it's really bad. All those negatives take away from that one little positive that I can see. And that's the only positive I can see in it.
So in your, quote, more normal state, you're much less driven.
Right. I'm less driven. And
well, it would seem to me that if you found yourself, if you were aware that your irritability level, irritation level, was going up, and you also felt compelled to reach a certain goal, almost to the point of an obsession, that would tell you that maybe you were going into your, quote, the manic, you know, into the extreme part of your behavior, that those would be telltale signs. That's my simple logic mind concluding that, but maybe it's
that,
too easy for me. That's too easy a solution.
Yeah, it is in a sense because, I mean, like I said before, it's so much easier from someone looking at you, knowing you, to tell you that you're manic. But see, you know, you can see them as signs, but then you don't really see them as signs. You just see them as this is just me. This is just how I am today. And that's why it is so hard. It is so hard to know. I mean, like I said, the only time, for my instance, that I know that I was in it is when I was out of it, and I look at what I did that was not Mark Woodhouse. That is so untypical of me that I knew that I wasn't the same person that I am right now speaking to you.
Now, are you continuing to get help for this?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I am.
So you've been over all this territory 1,000 times.
Yeah, see, I had different psychiatrists, but I felt that this one psychiatrist that I had, I didn't feel close to him. I didn't feel that I can just talk to him easily as I could any other of my friends.
Like we're talking right now.
Right. I just didn't feel that closeness. And the psychiatrist I'm seeing now, I've only had him for about 3 months. I've seen him 3 times. But, you know, I feel a lot closer to him than I do with my other psychiatrist. So I could talk to him a little more. And I the first thing I asked him, I said, can you, you know, look up in your information or just, you know, see what can I take? I told him all the medications that I took. And he was telling me pretty much what the other psychiatrist told me. And I was at right now, at this point in time, there's nothing out there that I can recommend for you to take. He said, because right now you are not in a manic episode state. He said, but there are things that I can tell you what you should take when you're in it. And the bad thing about it is that when you're in it,
you don't know.
So it's a catch 22.
On some philosophic level, you must be developing a feeling about how this will affect what you do in life. You can take the attitude that since I'm never, quote, normal in the standard way, what's the point of me trying anything? I mean, that would be a totally depressed. Another approach might be, all right, I have this thing. Nobody seems to know what it is. But nonetheless, I'm a human being. I still want to learn. And even in either my manic state or my normal state, I still get certain pleasures from life. I still have certain basic needs. Mm-hmm. I still have a need to relate to other people, to relate to a woman or whatever, or I still have a need to do something in terms of a vocation. Your life doesn't stop as a result of your being in mood X or mood Y. Life still goes on, and there's a common thread of needs. There's a common morality which goes through both those moods, isn't there? Yeah, your interpretation of right and wrong doesn't alter, does it?
It's like I can look at being in my manic state pretty much as being on alcohol. It's an influence, you know, and then, see, in a sense, okay, going through my first and second episode at Michigan State, I did things that were uncalled for. I did things that were not me, and they were not accepted to any community. I'll give you one instance, okay? When I'm manic, I play my music loud. And that's one thing you don't do in East Lansing, Michigan. Do not play your music loud. Because that, you know, there were a lot of complaints of neighbors that I had. You know, you do it, but you don't feel that you're doing anything wrong. That's one instance that I did. Also, another very important thing is that being agitated, being very aggressive. Now this is another thing. You don't see yourself aggressive, but everybody, the majority of people, see you too aggressive to them. You know, now, whether it be talking to them, okay, you're talking in an aggressive manner, in a manner that's just not polite, like I said, for any community. Okay, and then, physically, when it came to me playing basketball, I would play basketball because when I knew I was in a state of mind, like I'm still saying, you don't know, but there's something inside of you, okay, that is driving, burning, that has all this energy, I would go and play basketball. And then, in this tendency,
the bodies would be laid out across the court? I mean, did you get really physically tough?
I was highly physical, highly aggressive, going at it. I mean, it's funny. It's like, in a sense, it brings you to another level, another energy level. During this particular time, I mean, like, when I told you, you know, you average like 3-4 hours sleep, when you wake up, you pop up, you're ready to go. You're there. You're like, I can do it. I can do anything in the world. I have the power. I can do it. And that's what you're feeling. I mean, there were times like when I was manic, you know, you play so aggressive, you hit the ball so hard, and then you end up, you know, maybe hitting this person because you're so aggressive that right there, you know, you're not playing in a sense normal. I mean, basketball, period, is a physical sport, but you can take it to an extent to where, you know, how active you are is not common. It's not the right thing to do. See, it's so confusing. I mean, it really is. And then, okay, now, thinking of all of this and being manic depressant, and right now, at this moment, I am not. And now, one thing I
Bruce,
feel
how do
about
you know
this,
that you're not? If you do not know that you're in that state, how can you say that you are not now?
Not now. Well, one thing is that
you haven't punched me in the nose. I'm just joking.
No, I'm just joking. The one thing now is that I sleep regularly.
Okay.
I eat regularly. Well, one thing too, people aren't coming up to me saying, "Mark, you're not the same person you are." Strangers that you don't know are not offended by you. That's one of the big things. I mean, one of the big things is just that your sleeping patterns. I mean, if I can, you know, next time I go in my manic state, and if for some reason I can sit down and say, you know, for this whole week, I've only slept 2 hours a day.
Now, at the beginning of this conversation, you said, I'm just trying to look at the logic of this, because that's the only way I can approach this since I'm not a psychiatrist. But you said that you didn't know. And now you have made it very clear that there are certain signs which make it perfectly obvious that you're in one of these states, the most obvious being the sleeping pattern. That should tell you in about 2 seconds. If you're only sleeping 4 hours a night and you're popping up getting ready to charge another windmill the minute that you wake up, that should tell you right away. But the more interesting question for me is, all right, here I am, I have these mood shifts. How does that ultimately affect what you're going to do with your life in terms of working or not working, in terms of pursuing goal X or goal Y, in terms of looking for a job with a small TV station in North Platte, Nebraska? You know, as I was saying earlier, you can use your state to justify anything that happens in your life.
Right.
That's one approach. Or you can say, I will attempt to achieve something, I don't know what it is, a something, in spite of these mood shifts, whatever you want to call them.
Well,
now, I don't know to what extent you've sorted all of that out.
Well, there's two things that I think about. Okay, the first thing is that I'm scared. Why? Is because, let's say you're striving towards your goal. You know, whether someday I want to be a director, producer, or I just want to be within this field, within some field, you're going at your goal, you're doing what you have to do, your credibility is good. You know, people know you as a person that can work. The one thing that I am so scared of is, what if, you know, your manic state pops up? And because I'm so scared of that, for all the hard work that you have done goes right down the drain from things you may do. That's not normal. See, that's one thing that I am so scared of. Like, in a sense, you know, I wanted to work for CNN, you know, had an interview with them. I wasn't qualified in a sense, but I would think, you know, hey, I want to work for the CNN. Or I want to work for Arsenio Hall Show or any other major label or whatever that's known. I finally get there. I'm working it. Pow, something happens. That's what I'm scared of. But then also, too, in the same sense, I'm thinking that, you know, I don't want to be in the house all day wondering, you know, if my Maddox episode is going to happen, blaming that for an excuse of, I'm not going to do anything in life and sit around the house watching soap operas, you know, eating, getting fat and lazy. I don't want to do that. So in a sense, I have to move on. I have to try to do what I can do in my life so I can become fulfilled.
You know, there's one possibility in all this. If you know you have these mood shifts, then the likelihood of having a 9-to-5 job doesn't fit that pattern. What might be the answer here is a kind of worker activity which in some way accommodates these mood shifts. But the agony that you described is the agony which results when you are working for somebody else. You're going along at this level and you have a mood shift, and suddenly you do something which is not satisfactory to the employer. He says, oh my God, he's freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
Fire him. That's what you're afraid of.
Right, exactly.
So what I'm saying is that if you can find an activity, you can function productively, but because of your state, I'm assuming that everything you say is true,
mm-hmm.
You have to be more selective and what you decide to do. And maybe the answer is to focus in on something which is something which you can create by yourself. Now, whether that's freelance writing or functioning as a freelance still photographer or playing the trumpet, I don't know. But there might be an answer on some pursuit, with respect to some pursuit, which is more personal, which is more independent, which is outside of the company. Maybe you've thought about all this.
Not that in particular. Well, the one thing that I did think about, I talked this over with a professor of mine, and he knows about my my episodes. We've talked. He's helped out a lot, a great deal. The one thing that he told me that I may want to think about doing is that, you know, if I go to this structured company to where I've had a goal for working for and I finally get there and I'm working, that I may want to look into what sort of help this company may have while being at the job, you know, on the job. And if they do have some sort of facility or where they write down records, maybe where you could go to them and tell them, you know, point blank, after you get the job, that, you know, I am in this state. You know, this is a particular function of me to where I might.
After you've proven their worth, your worth to the company,
right,
you tell them this.
Right. I mean, it's like after I've got the job, because there's no way I'm going to put on a job application.
Then they won't hire you.
Yeah, that I'm in this state. There's no way. So, I mean, you know, get there, work for them in a while. I mean, not long, but, you know, long enough in a sense that, yeah, you've proven it in that you can work. But also, I want to let them know that I have this particular function or characteristic about me that may happen. You know, I want to explain this to you now so you know that if I ever get into this situation while I'm working for this company, what can I do so that I won't get fired? You know, the question is hard, but it's like I want to have it documented that I have this condition.
The
now,
other,
if
yeah.
I get in this condition, what can I do? You know, can I leave? Can I stay away to get myself together to come back so I can still work for this company?
I think so, that's basically sound advice. And anytime you're working within a structured environment, which any company or corporation is, of course, you know, that's, you're going to have to ask that question in some form or tell them in some way. I feel very strongly, though, that given your talent and your intelligence, that you can, in spite of this, still be very productive. Now, I don't know you that well, and maybe it's wrong for me to say this. It's a handicap, but it won't prevent you from leading a good life, a moral life, and a productive life related to some field. You'll have a tougher time because your choices are more limited. But there are people who, with much more severe handicaps than you have, who are highly productive. Mm-hmm. There are people who are stuck with epileptic seizures who function very productively. They're, you know, that one of those, you know, the grand mal epileptic seizure is a terrible thing to contend with.
There's one thing, too, you know, I'm thinking I'm 25, I've graduated, at least I have that particular goal that regardless of all what's happened to me, I have that paper. And now I think, you know, there's something out there for me. And, you know, this may be thinking, you know, optimistic or in a rose-colored glasses, but, you know, sometimes I think, you know, there is something out there for me. I'm destined for something.
You know, you got this far without even having a knowledge of this condition. Or for years you didn't have a knowledge of this condition. Don't let the knowledge of this condition destroy you. You got all the way through high school, all the way through college, in spite of this handicap, which for a long time you didn't even know you had. So if you've gotten that far without the knowledge of this condition, now that you know something about it, you should be able to go further.
Yeah.
Now that may seem like a rose-colored, overly optimistic view, but I think it's true, because I think that when you have a greater understanding of your situation, then you can define your limits more accurately and you can proceed more efficiently.